Our last class is called A Grand Illusion. A Grand Illusion. And now be prepared. You're going to hear Narada Muni at his very best. He's busy. He's just about to try to cut to pieces this very, very, very attached king's material attachments. So be prepared. If you feel a little uncomfortable, then that's because he has his operating knife just quite near to you. So be tolerant, because his words are being designed to destroy in the heart the tendency towards fruitive work. Fruitive work, we've heard this term many times, that the other sages born from Lord Brahma were experts in fruitive work. They could teach you how you could elevate yourself from one good position to a better one, just like in the business world, right? Where we were staying, there was one book that Aniruddha was perusing. It was called The Best Strategic Planning for Those Who Are Busy People and Want to Get the Fastest Results in the Quickest Time. And so you open the book and you're like, whoa! And it's full of every word is selected for somebody who doesn't have very much time and they're very ambitious and they want to get great results out of their life, materially speaking. So here we're going to, because we're in that world, it's all around us, even if we ourselves are not caught up like this, we're in a world that works like this, and we're going to hear Narada Muni now put on the brakes very, very powerfully. Now, yesterday we heard about all the different family members in lineage coming from Dhruva Maharaj and originally coming from Swayambhuva Manu. And we came to the Prachetas, the 10 sons of Prachinna Barisat. And these 10 boys had been sent by their father to perform austerities, and they performed them dutifully and they came back. Be assured, those boys came home to their father. Although Daksha's sons did not, the Prachetas were very obedient. Now their father, his name was Barisat, and he became known by the name Prachinabari, because he was a very religious man, extremely religious. However, his conception of religion differed radically from the conception of religion that Narada Muni was about to introduce him to. His idea of religion was fruitive. That means he was performing so many Vedic yagyas, so many sacrifices, so many ritualistic ceremonies, and all the priests and himself and everyone concerned was very anxious for the elevation of his soul upwards and upwards towards higher and higher realms. And he was outstanding in this. He was expert in this. And he was doing it, it says that the whole world was covered by kusha grass with its tips pointed eastward. What this allegorically means is that when a sacrifice is performed, the kusha grass is laid down with the tips pointing eastward. And so then he would move from one place to another place and another place in his kingdom, and continuously he was performing these sacrifices. And Narada took note of him and decided that he wanted to help this king. He was fond of him. So he came to see him. I'll just get to the beginning of the story. He came to see the king. And the king, quite naturally, as was the culture, he offered all respects to Narada Muni, and Narada Muni sat down. And he said to the king, he asked him a question that was a little profound. He said to the king, "My dear king, what do you desire to achieve by performing these fruitive activities? The chief aim of life, the main purpose of life, is to get rid of all miseries and to enjoy happiness. But these two things cannot be achieved by fruitive activity." Now that was the first verse that struck me. That here Narada is saying, yes, this is the goal of life, to remove all miseries and to increase happiness. And sometimes we criticize materialistic people because this is their only purpose, to remove miseries and increase happiness. But once I was listening to a lecture and Srila Prabhupada was hammering and cutting and hammering, and he was doing a very strong presentation. And my materialistic mind was thinking, oh, I wish that he would say something nice. He keeps saying these things that are very, very harsh to my heart. And then suddenly he said, we are doing all of this to attain happiness. And I stopped and I heard this word happiness, and I suddenly thought, this is my misconception. I think of Krishna consciousness as almost a little deadly. I have to do it, but it's a little painful because it's going to cut this attachment and cut away at this and what I like I shouldn't have and so on and so forth. And this impression was given to me at a very young age when I was in my early 20s when I met Srila Prabhupada. The weight of his gravity and his total detachment from everything, and the intensity of all the material desires at that particular stage of life, when they met, I discovered, oh dear, this is quite intense, because Srila Prabhupada didn't budge from his position of transcendence. And my mind was going whirling around with all kinds of different thoughts and aspirations and tendencies and inclinations and desires. So hearing Srila Prabhupada talking gravely and then hearing this word happiness, I just suddenly got this mental impression that all this hard work, as we were hearing yesterday, Srila Prabhupada saying that he was happier in the beginning. And when asked why, because I didn't have to criticize. Because as soon as you start the process of Krishna consciousness, so much criticism has to go on. As a teacher, as a parent, he said, I was listening one time, he said that if you want to be a good parent, you have to constantly criticize your children. If you don't criticize your children, then they think whatever they're doing is all right. So who wants to be this kind of a parent? Everyone would like to make their children feel that love them and feel very much at home and happy and peaceful, stay within the family. But Srila Prabhupada was that kind of a parent. So he was always pointing out that this is not right and that is not right. But he didn't do it as we might do it, say, coming from something deep in our hearts of annoyance or some frustration with ourselves, even, that we see, look, he's doing that and I shouldn't do it, so he shouldn't do it. But Srila Prabhupada was transcendental to all these different modes of response. And seeing from up here, from this transcendental position, he never hesitated to point out anything. He didn't go out of his way to find fault. But when a fault was apparent, he didn't hesitate to point it out. But naturally, being the child underneath, he was saying when a child is young, a son is young, that this is the father's duty. But once the son, the boy, reaches up to the age of 16, he's a young man now, then you must stop. Because now you've done your work, now it's up to him. He has to, now you become his friend. Now you give him counsel, but you can't criticize and criticize and criticize. And he said, otherwise he may rebel. So our materialistic mind, as we get on, we all have our spiritual side, we all have our material side. Our material side, it also grows up alongside the spiritual. And it, when we hear these very strong instructions, if they happen to pass through and they come to our material intelligence feels uncomfortable. So if any of you feel any discomfort as we hear Narada Muni's instructions, you will know that this class for you is being successful. And if you don't feel anything, then you'll know that somehow or other Narada Muni didn't touch you with his mercy. But that discomfort that we feel, you mean to say I can't have a this? You mean I can't be a this? You mean that's not right? You mean this? You mean this? This discomfort is balanced by the process of mercy. Because once one sees what an awkward position one is in, and one decides to take some steps towards rectification of one's own consciousness, then one immediately recognizes that I need help. I can't do it myself. If I think I can do it myself, that's a product of my illusion, that I can do it. And the whole endeavor of Krishna consciousness, if you wanted to put it very succinctly, is a process of transition from independence of all kinds to depending on Krishna. And it may sound very nice, especially if I'm not a very independent, I'm a timid person, I may think I'm not a very independent person, I'm quite gentle and meek. But you touch the right button and you will discover that you're fiercely independent. You think, I will do it myself. And if I can't do it, then I'll ask for some help. And I don't like to bother the Lord. So I'll try my best to do it myself on my own resources. And this is the foolishness of the conditioned soul. So he's telling the king, you're looking for happiness. You're trying to reduce your unhappiness. But you'll never get any result of, in either of these departments by fruitive activities. This is a very profound statement because all our activities are also fruitful. We're doing something thinking of what will happen in the future. As long as you're thinking of the future, it's fruitive. So then we should say, oh, this is where the mind starts to get uncomfortable. It says, does that mean I shouldn't think about the future? I shouldn't plan? I shouldn't be responsible? I should just think, oh, who cares about the future? No, that's not what it means. But as long as you're thinking about the future, how I will get this and I will get that and this will go like this, that's called fruitive. You want to eat the fruit that's grown on the tree of your activities. So this is what the king wanted to do. And Narada Muni called this, and Srila Prabhupada called this, an illusion. This is Srila Prabhupada's purport. He says, in the material world, there is a great illusion which covers the real intelligence. A man in the mode of passion wants to work very hard to derive some benefit, but he does not know that time will never allow him to enjoy anything permanently. Compared with the work one expends, the gain is not so profitable. And even if it is profitable, it is not without the distresses. If a man is not born rich and he wants to purchase a house and cars and other things, he has to work hard day and night for many years in order to possess them. We all know this. Thus, happiness is not attained without undergoing some distress. This is what he wanted to tell the king. This is not the way to get rid of distress. You'll gain distress. This is not the way to get happiness because so much unhappiness has to go into achievement of what you want. Then the king replied, as we might reply if we were in touch with a representative of Narada. He said, my dear Narada, very respectful, he said, my intelligence is so entangled in fruitive work. Therefore, I actually can't understand what is the ultimate goal, the final goal of everything. Please instruct me in pure knowledge so that I can get out of this entanglement in fruitive work. Those who are interested only in a beautiful life, remaining as householders entangled with wife and sons and searching for wealth, think these things are life's ultimate goal. Such people wander in different bodies throughout this world without finding out what is the ultimate goal. So Narada, he had heard these, the king's submission. So he began. He said to the king, my dear king, you look up in the sky. The king is looking up behind him. He said, can you see all the animals? All the animals who are waiting to kill you and pierce you with iron horns? And the king is a little uncomfortable at this. And he explains, Srila Prabhupada actually explains, he doesn't explain this to the king, but he explains that he's performing these sacrifices, sometimes they're successful, and the animal offered gets another birth. Sometimes they're unsuccessful, and the endeavor hasn't given that fruit to the animal, to the person involved, and he's karmically responsible for all of their present suffering, and they're waiting to get him back. So this is the first thing. He wants to instill fear, first of all, in the heart of the king, who's expressing, I want to hear from you, but he's he's very, very entangled. So Narada Muni starts like that. Now the king is listening carefully. Then Narada says, now I want to tell you a very old story. This is a very, very old history. And it is about one person. He's a king, and his name is Puranjan. So Puranjan actually means, the definition is, that it means one who enjoys a body. Now Narada Muni, because he was determined to save this king, he was going to really cut hard, like somebody who has a major surgery required to save their life. and the surgeons have to go in and make hard choices. Maybe I have to chop a limb to save the body, and the person themselves wouldn't wish to have their limb chopped off, but they don't understand how seriously injured they are. So Narada said to the king, I want to tell you a story, and this story is allegorical, but factually he's going to tell the king the story of his life in an allegory. So he said, this King Paranjan, he was very strong, very handsome, very powerful. He was very celebrated and respected. And he had a friend, and his friend's name was Avijñāta. And Avijñāta means the unknown one. No one could understand the activities of his friend. So King Paranjan, he was looking for somewhere nice to live. He went here and there, there and here, looking this place, that place, this place, that place. But none of the places he saw really suited him. They didn't quite satisfy him. So finally he was traveling around and he was quite disappointed with the different places that he found. This, in the allegory, represents the soul and all the various bodies that they have taken, not quite satisfied anywhere. King Paranjan had unlimited desires for enjoyment, and consequently he looked everywhere, but his desires could not be fulfilled. He felt insufficient wherever he went. But then he came to a place. This place was on the southern side of the Himalayas, which means in India. So he took birth in India. And there he saw a beautiful city of 9 gates, allegorically the body, which was characterized by all auspicious facilities. The city was all surrounded by beautiful parks and gardens, and the city was very pleasing. And within the city he saw there were windows and outlets and towers and canals, and all these things have allegorical meaning, but I won't be able to explain them to you now. And the floors of the houses of that city were made of jewels, and everything was very nice, and all the houses in the capital of that city were compared to the celestial town known as Bhogavati. So he looked here and there, he looked at all the facilities of the city, and he liked it very much. And then on the outskirts of the city, there was a beautiful garden with lakes and trees and so forth. And he came there, and in that atmosphere he was looking around and he saw that it was just like springtime. Now this is compared to family life. And in this beautiful, peaceful place, he saw that all the animals who normally fought with each other, they were all non-violent and just like sages. Very peaceful family situation. And over and above everything was the cooing of the cuckoos, which is considered like the sweet sound of the wife and the babies when they go coo, 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 coo. And the father thinks, oh, this is all worth it. So he went, he was looking around there, he thought this is very beautiful. And while he was looking at all of this, all of a sudden he saw this beautiful woman. She was so beautiful. He looked at her and thought, she's so beautiful. When he came in contact with her, she was just wandering there. She didn't have anything to do, just peacefully wandering in the garden. And he looked and he saw that she had 10 servants. These 10 servants represent the 10 senses, the 10 work, 5 working senses, 5 knowledge acquiring senses. And the beautiful woman, we will understand, allegorically represents the material intelligence. And literally, for Paranjan, this was his wife who he was completely infatuated with. So this beautiful woman, she was walking along, she had 10 servants, and each one of those servants had hosts of women following behind them. So there were so many women. And all these women are all the desires that are attached to each of our particular senses. And behind her, looming behind her, very powerful, was this big serpent. And it had 5 heads. And this serpent was the protector of this woman. And the serpent moved. Wherever she moved, this serpent moved. So this serpent is considered to be like the life airs in the body. The serpent lives, eats only air. So the life is in the body. It means the air in the body that sustains life. There are five different kinds of airs in the body. And when they're kept in good order, then one has good health. And if these airs become arrested or disturbed, then one can have bad health, madness, or even death. So this serpent was protecting her on all sides. She was so beautiful and young, and she appeared very anxious to find a suitable husband. So she's described how she was dressed and decorated, and when she walked, her ankle bells tinkled so charmingly. And she looked exactly like a heavenly goddess. She was trying to cover herself in shyness and modesty, but she was sort of failing to do so. This was even more attractive to the king. He was such a hero. He became attracted immediately and pierced in his heart with love for this beautiful woman. She smiled shyly at him, and he could not refrain from addressing her. So he said to her, "My dear, beautiful woman, please tell me, who are you? Where are you coming from? And whose daughter are you?" So he's asking all the right questions to find out all about this beautiful woman. He said, "You appear very chaste. What is your purpose of coming here? And what are you trying to do?" So he asked, here we go, "Who are you? Where do you come from? Who's your father? Because whose daughter are you? What is your purpose? Who are you? Where do you come from? Who's your father? What's your purpose? And what are you trying to do?" Now, so this is where Srila Prabhupada says, this is where one should ask these questions to one's own intelligence. These are the questions. Yesterday I was asked, what were the questions? We should ask our own intelligence. Who are you? Where do you come from? Who's your father? What are you trying to do? And what's your purpose in coming here? Now this beautiful girl will answer. So he says also, he asks, who are the bodyguards? Who are these men who are taking care of you? And who are all these women who are surrounding them? And why do the women follow the men? And who's the snake? Then he tried to woo her. He said, "You're just like the goddess of fortune, but no, you can't be Lakshmi because you're walking on the ground and Lakshmi walks beyond, above the ground. But you're so beautiful. Maybe you are the goddess of fortune and you threw your lotus somewhere. You're so beautiful." So he charmed her and she became very happy hearing all of these things that he said. And he hinted to her that he would be very attracted if he could make some kind of relationship with this beautiful woman. So then this beautiful girl replied. She smiled and accepted his request for talking because she was already attracted to the king. And she said, now listen to her answers. This is the answers of an untrained materialistic intelligence. The girl said, "O best of human beings, I do not know who has begotten me. And I cannot speak to you perfectly about this. Nor do I know the names or the origin of the associates with me." I don't know. This is called what?
Ignorance.
"We only know that we're existing here. We don't care what will come after. Indeed," says she with a little flutter of her beautiful eyelashes, "we are so foolish that we don't even care to understand who has created this beautiful place for our residence. We're not interested in that. My dear gentlemen, all these men and women with me are known as my friends, and the snake, who always remains awake, protecting my city even during the sleeping hours, I don't know who he is. So much I know, I do not know anything beyond this." Basically, I don't know any of these things. "But you have somehow or another come here, and this is a great fortune for me. So I wish all auspicious things for you, because you have a desire to satisfy your senses. And all my friends and I shall try to our very best to fulfill your desires." So here is the soul entered into the body, and here are the facilities of the body, all now available. Now you can enjoy it. She said, "I have arranged the city of 9 gates for you, and you can have all kinds of enjoyment and live here for 100 years. And all facilities for enjoyment will be supplied by me." So then she goes on and she says, in material life, a householder's life brings all kinds of happiness in dharma, artha, karma, and moksha. Nobody who is a renunciate can imagine the happiness, all the material happiness you can have in householder life with me. According to authorities, householder life is very pleasing not only for oneself, but for all your forefathers, all the demigods, all the great sages, and everyone else. So please enter into the city with me. Become my husband, and we will enjoy life together. So, Puranjan, he's feeling so fortunate, greatly fortunate, and therefore both the man and woman enter into the city. So this is the material intelligence and the consciousness. So they entered into the city, and then Narada Muni is telling the story, this allegory to the king, who's very fruitive. It's kind of a cutting story, listening to this. And he explains that this city had 9 gates. Right? So these 9 gates, he said, there were some on the east, some on the west, some on the north, some on the south. So he said, the ones on the east are the ones on the front of the face. The ones on the west are the ones at the bottom of the body. The ones on the north are the ear. And on the south is the other ear. So the king was living in this body, and he was enjoying life. He would go in and out of these gates whenever he chose with his queen and all of her followers. He would go here, there, everywhere, here. And he had a wonderful time. So this is all explained, what he would do in those different places. So he became completely under the control of his material intelligence, and therefore he was cheated. Indeed, he used to fulfill all the desires of his wife, the queen, his intelligence. So this is how Narada Muni is talking to the king. He says, when the queen drank liquor, the king also started to drink. When the queen dined, he would dine with her. When she chewed, Puranjan also chewed along with her. When the queen sang, he also sang. Similarly, when the queen cried, he also cried. When the queen laughed, he also laughed. When the queen talked loosely, he also talked loosely. When the queen walked, the king walked beside her. When the queen would stand still, the king would stand still. And when the queen would lie down to bed, he would also lie down with her. When the queen sat, he would sit. And when the queen heard something, he would follow her to hear the same thing. This is the particular situation of a conditioned soul. He goes along with the whole thing, with the whole thing of his intelligence, conditioned material intelligence. When the queen smelt something or saw something, the king would also do that. And when the queen touched something, the king would touch it. When the queen was lamenting, the poor king had also to follow her in her lamentation. And in the same way, when the queen felt enjoyment, he also enjoyed. When the queen was satisfied, the king was also full of satisfaction. In this way, he was captivated by his nice wife and cheated. So this is the story as it's proceeding that King Puranjan, the king is hearing about Puranjan. Then he explains a section which I will not read, how the king one day goes to the forest to hunt without permission of his wife. And this is explained later means that sometimes the living entity acts impiously without consulting his intelligence. So the king went hunting and he killed so many animals. He enjoyed himself killing animals and killing animals and killing animals. But he hadn't actually consulted his wife. He hadn't taken her with him. And so when he became tired of all this impious activity, doing this and doing that and so forth, he became tired. He wanted to go home now. He returned to the palace and he wanted to refresh himself, but he couldn't find his queen. She was not available for him. So he took his meal and he did everything. Then he asked the maidservants, "Where is the queen?" And they said, "Oh, well, that's a little strange. She's in her room, I think, but she's taken off all her decorations. She's thrown them all on the ground, and she's lying down on the floor as if she was a mendicant. So what can happen is so much sinful activity, and then artificially the intelligence says, 'Now I want to renounce everything.' No more. I don't want to be involved in these things anymore. So the queen was angry. So she lay on the ground. And Puranjan came into the queen's room. And he spoke wonderfully sweet words to her and convinced her, "My dear queen, please forgive me. I have disobeyed you. I should not have done this and that and so many things. But now I will listen to you. Please get up. Please put your ornaments on again so we can enjoy and be happy together." And so the queen got up and she decorated herself and life went on. So this relationship continued and continued. And in this way, they both became oblivious to the passing of time. Now Narada Muni will introduce another character. He is called Chandravega. So Chandravega represents time. So the king and the queen were having so much fun, so much pleasure together. And meanwhile, before Chandravega comes, of course, they have to have so many sons and so many daughters. And these are the accumulated desires that come. We do one thing, we get 10 more desires. We do those things, we get 10 more desires. We get more desires and more desires. So this was King Puranjan's family. And then he had to get them all married. So he had them all married. And in this way, in his kingdom, he was surrounded by his family members, happy or unhappy, and he was taking care of them all very happily. And this was how he was filling his time. These sons and grandsons, which represent all these desires that come into our mind, virtually plundered King Puranjan's riches, including his home, treasury, servants, secretaries, and other paraphernalia. Puranjan's attachment for all these things was very deep rooted. Then, at the same time, Narada Muni says, and also King Puranjan was implicated in killing so many animals. He's dropping this in again for the king, because this was the king that he was specifically speaking this story to. Then Chandravega comes along, and Chandravega is a Gandhava, and he's a soldier, and he has under him 360 powerful Gandhava soldiers. So these 360 Gandhavas represent the days of the year. And each of these Gandhavas had a wife, which represents the 360 nights of the year. So along with Chandravega were many female Gandhavis, and they repeatedly plundered the paraphernalia of Puranjan for their enjoyment. The five-hooded serpent, Puranjan, fought with these Gandhavas. For 100 years, he fought alone with all of them, although they numbered 720. So this is time. Time is always impacting us, and we're trying to get things done. We're pushing back. Time is coming this way, and we're trying to go that way. So the five-headed serpent is fighting with all these soldiers. And gradually, as we know, he becomes very tired. Now, time, Chandravega has a daughter. Again, allegorically, her daughter's name is Jara. So Jara represents old age. And Jara was looking here and there for somebody who would take her on. But she was not very attractive. Who wants old age? Practically speaking, nobody wants to grow old. Srila Prabhupada said, so much suffering in old age. And we're all just getting a little close and we're feeling, oh, so many different inconveniences are coming. So Jara was looking here and there for herself, for her husband, and she saw Narada. So she came to Narada and she spoke very sweetly to Narada and asked him if he would kindly accept her as his wife. And Narada very respectfully apologized to her. No, I'm very sorry. I'm a celibate. I cannot. So this represents that the celibacy of Narada, or the great exalted personalities, can push back the effects of old age. So there was Narada, he said. Then she got angry at me and she cursed me with the same curse. If you don't marry me, then you'll have to just wander everywhere. You won't be anywhere you can settle. Because if you settle, you have to marry me. So he said, all right, he accepted this curse. And then she said she wanted then to marry somebody. So he said, all right, you can get married to the king of the Yavanas. The king of the Yavanas, whose name is Bhaya, or fear. You, old age, can marry fear. Because in old age, fear becomes very prominent. So then he said, the king of the Yavanas had a friend, and his name, I don't have it right here, but his name, he was the fever that comes at the end of life. There's a fever that when it's time to leave the body, the temperature goes so high, Srila Prabhupada said, and then it drops. And at that point, one time I heard on a tape in the early years that he said that the coldness that follows that fever, because fever always has heat and cold, right? If you have malaria, you get chills, and then it's a very high temperature. So when that fever goes so high, it turns into a chill, and that cold you cannot tolerate. And then that is the point of death. So these three got together, and they started traveling everywhere together. It's fever at the time of death, fear and old age, they come together. So off they went, here and there and here. And they came and they saw Puranjan city, and they saw that it was already being attacked by all these soldiers, and they decided to also take part in this. So then, when the city was being attacked, the city of Puranjan was overcome by the Gandharvas and the other soldiers, and though the king had no desire to leave it, he was circumstantially being forced to do so, for it was being smashed by Kalakanya, which was this fever that comes at the end. So the city was set ablaze, and all the citizens and servants of the king, as well as all his members, family members, sons, grandsons, wives, and everybody were all set on fire. And King Kuranjan became very unhappy, and they forced him. First they forced the snake to leave. And when the snake was forced to leave, all the family members were forced to leave. Now this explains that in the subtle body, all your desires are carried to your next body. They don't go down with the city of nine gates. They all leave. They go with Puranjan. So Puranjan, at the time of his departure from his body, he was thinking, who was he thinking of? He was thinking of his queen, who had served him so lovingly throughout her life. Everything he wanted, she gave him. Everything he ever asked for, she did. And now he was going to be separated from her. So he was thinking of her. And then what happened was, he therefore took the body of a woman. Continuing this allegory, Narada explains that the king, was born as the princess of a king of Vidarbha. And all these points have some allegorical sense. And the queen, this princess, she was very pious. She was very nice because Puranjan was pious. And so she married, when she grew up, the king of Malayadwaj, and he was a great devotee. So she came in touch with a great devotee. And she had 9 sons and 1 daughter. And these sons were very nice. They were very, very good. They represent the different processes of devotional service. And the one daughter had black eyes. She was very beautiful. And she represents the spontaneous process of devotional service. Her eyes are black because she has her eyes fixed on Krishna. And so therefore her eyes become blackish. So he married all of his daughters and sons off. And she was a very chaste wife, who was Puranjan. And then Malayadwaj, at the end of his life, he went to the forest. She also went to the forest. And she served her husband very faithfully in the forest. She was a very good queen. And she was serving and serving the king. And then, at a certain point, he was becoming more and more and more realized. And as he became more and more and more spiritually advanced, his age was also coming. And while she was practicing his meditation and she was serving very faithfully in a very humble way, he suddenly left his body. Alone there in the forest, he disappeared. And she was serving and serving, but suddenly she noticed that his body was cold. And then she understood that her husband had left. So then, when she understood that he had actually passed from his body, she felt great anxiety at being left alone. So then she became very unhappy, began to lament. She was beating her chest and crying and throwing herself on the ground in the absence of her husband, and crying very loudly. And at that time, as she was preparing to light the fire, she was going to enter the fire as well. She had no more reason to live. Her husband had gone. At that particular point, in that solitary forest, a Brahmin came. And this Brahmana, if you remember, he was an old friend of the king. The king once had a friend. And his friend he was unknown to the king. So this friend of the king, Puranjan, came to that place and began to satisfy the queen with very sweet words. The Brahmin said to Puranjan, now an elderly lady crying, "Who are you? Whose wife or daughter are you? And who is this man lying here? It appears you are lamenting for this body, but don't you recognize me? I am your eternal friend. You may remember that many times in the past you have consulted me." So the queen is listening to this person who has come to help her at her time of need. The Brahmin said, "My dear friend, even though you cannot immediately recognize me, can't you remember that in the past you had a very intimate friend? Unfortunately, you gave up my company and accepted a position as an enjoyer in this material world." "My dear, gentle friend," is speaking to the queen, "both you and I are exactly like two swans. We live together in the same heart. Two swans in the water of the Manasi lake of the heart. Although we have been living together for many thousands and thousands of years, we are still very far away from our original home. You are now my very same friend. Since you left me, you have become more and more materialistic. And not seeing me, you have traveled in different forms throughout this material world, which was created by some woman." So this woman represents the material energy of the Lord, which is giving us opportunities one after another to enjoy in one form and another throughout many, many, many births, forgetting constantly our intimate friend. "My dear friend, the five objects of sense enjoyment and the protector, your life air, which passes through the nine gates, and all the aggregates and everything else, behind all this activity is the soul. The soul is a person and an enjoyer in reality. However, because he is now hidden within the city of nine gates, he is totally devoid of knowledge. My dear friend, when you entered such a body, along with the woman of material desires, you became overly absorbed in sense enjoyment, and because of this, you have forgotten your spiritual life. Due to your material conceptions, you are placed in various miserable conditions. Actually, you are not the daughter of Vidarbha, nor were you this man Malayadwaj. Nor is this man Malayadwaj your well-wishing husband. Nor were you actually the husband of Puranjani. You were simply captivated in the city of nine gates. Sometimes you think yourself a man. Sometimes you think yourself a woman. Sometimes you think yourself a neutral eunuch. All this is because of the body, which is created by the illusory energy, and that illusory energy is my potency. And actually, both of us, you and I, are pure spiritual entities. Now just try to understand this. I'm trying to explain to you our factual position." So he continued to speak like this, that there is no difference between you and I. And in this way, he spoke, "in this way both swans live together in the heart. When one swan is instructed by another swan, he is situated in his natural position. This means he regains his original Krishna consciousness, which has become lost because of his material attraction." So this is what I was saying in the beginning. Here we are, traveled through so many lives. We are the Puranjan in the body. We have the beautiful wife, which is our material intelligence. And we are situated like this, But we also have this friend who wants to tell us how to get out. Having heard all of this, the whole allegory had been told now, and the king was sitting there. And what do you think he said? You might think he thanked Puranjan very, thanked Narada Muni and said this was very revealing. But he didn't. Interestingly, again, he's sort of similar to us. He said to Narada Muni, he said, "My dear Lord, we couldn't actually understand anything that you were saying. I couldn't understand what you're talking about." He says, those who are perfect in spiritual knowledge, they can understand, but we're fruitive, you know. How can we understand what you're saying? So when I read that, I thought, very good. The Narada had another chance, and he spoke to him and he explained his allegory. We have heard some of that already. He explained all of that. And then he talked about how in one life this happens, in the next life that happens, and so on and so forth. And the king asked a final question. He asked him, how is it that if we do something in one life, it's the result of our last life, we do it in one life, how is it that next life we have to suffer it, is a different body? How come we have to have that next life? Because that was last life. How does it work? So as he was explaining like that, asking that question, then Narada Muni, now I won't go into all the details here also, but he spoke an answer to him. He told him, of course, about the transmigration of the soul according to his work. And he explained everything about the queen being the intelligence again. And he talked about how in one life to the next, it's like carrying a burden. We carry it in one life on our head. And it's burdensome, like you see this in India, someone's carrying something on their head. Or a mother with a child, and then she puts it on her shoulder. And she carries it on her shoulder for a while, and her head feels much better. But the shoulder is still feeling the weight of the burden. So then you move it and carry it like this for a while, and you carry it like this, carry. But then it's still heavy, so then you put it back on your head. And this adjusting and adjusting makes you manage to cope with the inconvenience of this burden. But you're not actually getting rid of it, you're just shifting the weight. So this is what we do, life after life, we shift the weight. And Narada said, if you have a bad dream, you can't counteract it with another bad dream. You have to wake up. This is the only solution. You have to wake up. And he said, our ignorance in material life is due to ignorance and illusion. Our material existence is due to ignorance and illusion. We have to awaken our Krishna consciousness. Then he spoke some further instructions to the king about the mind. He speaks about dreams. They're very profound points he makes. In fact, this is one of the most mysterious parts of the Bhagavatam. He talks at one point how Krishna can, if he desires, with a sincere soul, because we're carrying this like a mountain of karmic reactions, and that's why we have to take another body. Krishna can bring that whole aggregate together so that in one moment, a sincere soul can see the whole of all of his karma in one moment and it's gone. So this is a very mysterious concept, and I cannot answer any of the questions that might arise in your mind because they also arose in my mind. But he explained all about this and how dreams work, how this is something to do with what you cannot dream anything you haven't seen. And if you see something in a dream you've never seen before, you must have seen it before somewhere. So then he said, dreaming and everything is all due to mental impressions. And when you want to have a chance to act them out, you get another body. So how careful we have to be. We have so many things, I'd like this, I'd really like this. We're preparing ourselves for another body. So what to do about this? This is fruitive work. We have to take those same tendencies. We have to do them. We have the impulses to do them and we have to dedicate them. And to do that, Narada will go back to his original point, is you have to hear about Krishna. If you don't hear about Krishna, but side by side, if you don't hear about the uncertainty of happiness in this world, alongside of hearing about Krishna, you won't be able to make the consciousness transferal to make an offering of these things to Krishna rather than taking them for oneself. This is the process, gradual process that Krishna consciousness implies. So then at the end of this story, he's told him everything about the mind. There's a very nice benediction given because we've all sat here so patiently and listened. So then, Narada Muni says, having explained many things, he says to the king, if anyone can understand the purpose of this allegory, he will certainly be relieved from the bodily conception of life. And he will certainly understand life after death. Although one may not understand what transmigration of the soul actually is, one can fully understand it by studying this narration. So Srila Prabhupada is giving us his comments on this. The last verse, because the last verse is usually very helpful, he says, everything happening within time, which consists of past, present and future, is merely a dream. This is very, very much something we have to think about. It's just a dream. That is the secret understanding of all the Vedic literatures. And Prabhupada tells us, factually, all of material existence is only a dream. Thus, there is no question of past, present and future. People who are addicted to karma kandya vichar, which means working for future happiness through fruitive activities, are also dreaming. Similarly, past happiness and present happiness are merely dreams. The actual reality is Krishna and service to Krishna, which can save us from the clutches of Maya. For the Lord says in Bhagavad Gita, those who are surrendered unto me can easily cross beyond my illusory energy. So this is the final story that I wanted to share with you, the story of Puranjan. It's Narada Muni at his best. Everything is there in the allegory. You can read, there's like 5 or 6 chapters involved. And I would say even to prepare it was quite difficult because it's so profound as Narada is speaking. And the king, as a result of hearing this information, because Narada, at certain points, he understood that the king wasn't paying attention. He wasn't getting the point. So he upped his intensity as he spoke to the king. He told him one story I didn't include about 2 deers. There's a deer in the forest with his wife deer. And they're eating the grass and enjoying the pleasant company of each other. But they don't see in front of them there's a tiger just getting ready to eat them, stealthily coming towards them. And if they should run away from the tiger, they don't see behind them there's a hunter who has his bow aimed ready. So he was telling the king, which may not be the instruction for us, because we are given our own duties according to our situation, but to this king he was telling him, get out of here immediately. He was so addicted to this way of life. He said, leave here immediately. And he said, what I'll do is, when my sons come back, I'll get everything, I'll hand everything over to my sons. He said, don't wait for your sons to come back. And he sent the king off. And the king left everything in the hands of his ministers, all the instructions for his sons when they returned. And he was already had to get out of that place very quickly because of his attachments. And the king went to the forest. He followed the instructions of Narada and he was successful. So we too should try to, whatever we have, whatever we know, whatever we've heard that applies to us, we should try to follow it in our heart. And therefore we also will become successful. So thank you. Are there any questions? Yes.
I just want to know, where is it found in the Srimad
Bhagavatam? In the 4th canto. Okay.
Which chapter?
Chapters 25, I think, to 29. Possibly earlier. No, 25 to 29. Yeah. Yes.
King Puranjana, when he was leaving the city of 9 gates and he was landed in the, he was thinking about his queen, but actually in the allegory the queen represents our intelligence. Hmm?
Yes.
So usually the intelligence also is part of the subtle body,
yes,
along with the soul. So
yes.
How do we understand that?
He didn't want to leave the city. No one wants to leave the city. He had so much fun. He could go in and out these gates and he could go out these gates, and he had it all set up nicely for him. And his queen, His intelligence had helped him to, it was enjoying the city in so many ways. And the allegory describes some of the things he was enjoying in the city and what he did when he went out each of these gates. And of course, when he went out each of these gates, he met all those attendants, which are his desires, and they're considered like the jewels in the ground of his beautiful city. So he didn't want to give any of that up. And factually, what happened was he had to leave the city, but he took that all with him. They all had to leave too. Get out, get out, get out. Time said, all of you out. And then he found himself in the corresponding next situation.
The intelligence also goes.
Yeah. But when the intelligence is in the next situation, we hear from Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is saying, I'm situated in everyone's heart. From me comes knowledge, remembrance, and forgetfulness. So the intelligence doesn't activate the next situation. It's powerless to do that. But Krishna activates the intelligence so that the Puranjan can work out his next circumstance. But he met a devotee, so his life as a queen became auspicious. Yes.
You were mentioning about as soon as you're working and you're thinking about the future, that means it's fruit of activity.
Yeah.
Say your work is to distribute Srila Prabhupada's books, then I thought it's ideal for me to go out and wait and drink. Like my husband says.
That's not fruit of activity though. But if there's mixture. In other words, the idea to distribute Srila Prabhupada's books is not fruitive activity. But if, and there is in us always, a little mix, there's also sort of like, for example, Srila Prabhupada very expertly used there was a little mixture in all of his disciples, so he said, okay, we'll have scores and we'll write up on the top, you came first, you came second. And then the people who had a competitive spirit, that would inspire them, yes, I came first. But that's to utilize the fruitive mentality. But the distribution of the books is not fruitive mentality. So we use the fruitive mentality in the service of devotional activities. But if we don't know that that's a fruitive mentality I'm using in the service of Srila Prabhupada, then what happened was many times people left with their fruitive mentality, took them away again. There's so many cases of that. I remember there was one girl in America, and she was in New York, and we were in Gita Nagari. And Gita Nagari was a homely place, something like New Nandagram. And this was in the days when everything, they had divided, there was a division, it was in and out, but it wasn't like, there was a division they had, anyone lived outside the temple was meaningless. You had to live in the temple. This is the early days where all there was so much fervency. But then there was a division inside the temple. You were a temple devotee or a Sankirtan devotee. And a temple devotee had to be looked down on to boost up the spirits of the Sankirtan devotee. And so the Sankirtan devotee looked down on the temple devotee, and both of them looked down on the people that lived outside. And we lived in a humble farm community that was being supported by the income from the Sankirtan devotees. So we were considered the lowest on the step ladder. You had children, you know, this is a fruitive activity. You know, we were in Maya and they weren't, and so forth. So I used to go to New York, and this girl, she wasn't married and she had so much fire. She had a lot of shakti. And she was going out and she was distributing so many books, and she was number one, and she was number one of number one, and she was the top of this and the top of that. And then, you know, 2 or 3 years later, I remember coming back, and she'd got married and she had children and she was encumbered and she was looking for a job, and she was totally a different person. And I was thinking, oh, there must have been a mix there, and Prabhupada was using it very cleverly in Krishna's service. But if you don't know there's a mix, then that same competitive spirit will take you into another arena. So we use it. We make plans using the competitive spirit to do this with it instead of to do that with it. And that's how we change that competitive spirit into a devotional spirit. So there are some places now you see in Krishna consciousness where the devotees are more mature, and the best devotee is the best servant. And that the devotees are trained, don't criticize devotees. And then they look up to the person who doesn't criticize devotees most. And they respect people who don't, you know, who serve other people. There you've got a different paradigm. But this is more sattvic, this is more purified, more mature. But Prabhupada was dealing, we were straight off the street with lots of energy. What do you want to do with it? Yes, go out there and do double and then do triple. And then, so he used it. So we don't condemn it. We don't say, no, you can't have that. But know what it is. Do you understand? Distinguish between the two and use it well.
But the thing is that if Srila Prabhupada wants his books distributed,
yes,
then actually it'd be ideal to be thinking like that. Like, because if you were always like saying, well, you know, Krishna willing, you'll take the book. Whatever,
yes,
you want, take it if you want.
Yes.
I'm not attached,
yes,
to Krishna, it's not,
yes,
up to me, then,
yes,
perhaps less books would be distributed. So
yes,
actually maybe it's better that we are competing.
In that area it is. In that area it is. But Srila Prabhupada told one of his famous book distributors who was fierce on the street, She could distribute books and books and books and books, and he glorified her for that. But he said, when you come home, you have to be like a lamb. When you go out, you should be like a lion. When you come home, you should be like a lamb. So to do that, we have to understand both of these mentalities and when to use that. And we must do that then. We should make so many plans and we should be fiery. But it's not easy to make that transit. Lamb, lion, lamb, lion. Mostly you find lambs and lions. You know, but that's what he instructed her, so that she could turn it up. It's like, you know, if you have a fan in here and it just has a switch and you turn it on, and we're all studying, say we're studying many papers before us, and you turn on the fan, it blows all the papers everywhere. And it's annoying because it's all the papers are in. You've got to keep holding on to the papers and you think, it's the fan. You can't turn it off because you need the air, but it's too much. So then, if you had somebody come in and they put a regulator on the fan, as they do in India, because I've had this experience in India, they put a regulator on the fan, then you can turn it up and down according to how you want. So when you just have a few people in the room, it's not so hot outside, you turn it down, and then you can get all your work done. But then when you want to, really want to turn it up, turn it all the way up, and fantastic. But you've got control of it by that regulator. So Shastra is like that regulating factor. And by that, then we can use that energy, not misuse that energy, or not waste that energy. But you've got to think that that energy that you have isn't yours, it's Krishna's. And he wants that. So he wants you to do that. Then your planning is to please him. That's not what's spoken about here. This is talking about the side of material intelligence, which is thinking, how can I get a such and such? And I get a this, and I get a that. So we employ that, as the queen was employed in the service of the king. And Prabhupada took, you know, powerful people and employed that power, that Shakti. But they had to, if they didn't understand that's Krishna's gift, they ended up becoming businessmen, executives, so many different things. And we thought they wouldn't. We thought, no, he's so great devotee. Boom, and what's that? And then we had to understand there's two things there. And Prabhupada was pulling the reins, but maybe they haven't been able to continue in that way. So we don't discourage that. Yes.
But in this example of King Puranjan, in this allegory,
yes,
where is the mind and false ego?
The mind and false ego? The mind and false ego. Oh, in the Puranjan also incorporates the false ego. As soon as he comes and he's looking for something, that's the false ego. It's, in other words, the soul covered by false ego. And the mind, in the beginning, it talks about 10 servants and their attendants. But then in the explanation to Puranjan, when he said, to Maharaj Prachinavahi, when he said, I didn't understand it, Narada incorporates 11 attendants. And one of them is the mind. They're all taking care of serving the queen. They're all servants of the intelligence. So the mind is there as well. Yes.
Nadaji was just mentioning about,
yes,
book distribution and schools, and like, you know, in devotional life we are always trying to gauge our bhakti sort of, like,
yes,
you know, how early we are getting up, based on that how much we have advanced. And
yes,
yesterday Guru Jantra was mentioning about gopi bhava, the vajrasi bhava, how,
yes,
even the blinking of eye was like a detrimental factor for them to see in Krishna.
Mm.
So I was just wondering, like, we have to try to achieve that goal following in the footsteps of the Brajavasis, and is it that only when we achieve that stage of bhakti do we get sort of entrance to Golok Vrindavan, or even in Golok Vrindavan there are people, there are devotees with different levels of love for Krishna, like some are gopis who are the best devotees, but there are lesser who don't love Krishna?
No, in Vrindavan pastimes on this earthly plane, as far as I remember Srila Prabhupada saying, people may be there who aren't perfect. But then they've come there because they're about to attain perfection. But in the spiritual realm, which they're non-different, this is inconceivable. One is here, one's there, but they're not different. There's nobody there who isn't perfect. They've completed the course. Now one may say, how did that come about? Did they all have to go this, or did some of them did it? How was that? So there's definitely different stories of different personalities who attained their perfection in different ways. So Srila Prabhupada emphasized not thinking about that so much. Right? This was his manner. He's talking to young people, brand new devotees, no idea of ABCD. When he gave the Nectar of Devotion, that was one of the early books. He gave Krishna books so early in 1970, and then he gave Nectar of Devotion, and he told the devotees, read it every day. And they started a class in the temple. We would read, and we'd go around after lunch and read. And then he said, if you have any questions, read it again. And if you have any questions, read it again. Because we had no frame of reference to answer any of the questions. So therefore he emphasized very much on you just do your best and Krishna will just, and you just, and it was like that. And that should not be minimized, that approach. One shouldn't think, now I know better than that. However, when you read, he also wanted us to read very thoroughly the teachings of the various acharyas and so forth. He wanted us to be learned alongside. Not everyone is going to be learned. Somebody can be simple and make, Krishna will arrange everything for them. But from the scientific point of view of Krishna consciousness, the explanation is given by the acharyas who Srila Prabhupada was taking his purports from, that there is a gradual elevation through 8 different stages, starting from the process of Shraddha, Sadhu Sangha, so on and so forth, up to the stage of Bhava Bhakti. So that process, it's not exactly like the end of the year you go up, the end of the year you go up. It's more subtle than that. It depends on the devotion and the devotee's determination. But we should go up. And generally, somebody doesn't enter into the spiritual world unless they're a Kripa Siddha until they attain Bhava, the platform of a budding lotus of love of Krishna. And then they enter into that. Because if they're there and they're there, so they just happen to sort of manage to push their way in, they won't know what to do because everybody there only serves Krishna, and our contamination is the desire for things to come towards me. So if they haven't yet got rid of that, they won't understand Krishna anyway. They'll think he's an ordinary man. Prabhupada said that. They may have been there when Krishna was on this planet, but they will see, oh, he's an ordinary person like me. So gradually one goes up in one's bhakti, and that can be accelerated by our determination, particular activities. Srila Prabhupada said, if you preach, Lord Chaitanya can take you up very quickly, Lord Nityananda can take you up very quickly, but gradually or quickly one goes up through those various processes and matures. And until then one stays in the maturing process. Like in school, right, you go to university and you graduate as a doctor when you've completed the course. And if you sort of skipped it all and said, now I'm a doctor and got a certificate and everything, you wouldn't be able to do your practice. So Krishna's very merciful. He arranges everything. He's personally interested in everyone, that intimate friend. He's saying, we're still a long way from home. So listen to me. I'm giving you advice and we can continue in this way.
So even in the stage of Mahava Bhakti or Prema Bhakti, when someone is gets qualification to enter into his pastime family.
Yes.
Are there varying degrees of love? Even in that stage, like...
Yes, you can say that. You can say that, but it's not really like that. It's like I could say, you love your husband more than his mother does. But can you really say that? Because you're his wife, you love him as a wife is a bit more accurate. And so you love your husband as a very good wife. His mother and father love him as his parents. So it's like that. It's not. But for technical, for tattva, tattva means to understand all the elements involved. Philosophy is based on tattva. And even we say pancha tattva, These are five personalities, but they represent different tattvas, different principles. So tattva means you have to say, yes, this is like this, and that's like that, that's compared to this, this is like this. But rasa, which is what goes on in the spiritual world, which is the love, nobody thinks I'm better or worse, or I wish I had that raw. I wish I hadn't chosen this, that would have been better. Nobody thinks like that. And Narada himself goes looking for the best devotee, the one who's got the most mercy from the Lord. And he goes from one to the next, and they keep saying, I'm not a good devotee, go and see him. So he goes to another one, and he glorifies them, because the person before has told him how great they are. He goes glorifying them. They say, oh, please don't glorify me, I'm just so fallen. They find so many faults in themselves, and they say, go on. So he goes on and on and on till he comes to Dwarka to see Uddhava. And when he sees Uddhava, then Uddhava knows, yes, everything you've said about me is correct, but I've just come back from Vrindavan and I've seen something that is so amazing, because he's seen the gopis' love. So then there's a scene in Dwarka, which is meant to show the extraordinary love of the devotees. But Sanatana Goswami, who's writing the Brihat Bhagavatamrita, he says, all these devotees were perfect. Not one of them is like down there and this one's up here and so forth. But for the purpose of understanding who has the most of the Lord's mercy, who's the most greatest devotee, it's the gopis. Everyone says it. Why? Because they give everything, 100%. The residents of Dwarka have children. They love their children in a very religious way, in a transcendentally religious way. But the gopis don't even have a relationship. To show this parakia, the love of the residents of Vrindavan, they're apparently married to others. So they don't even have a connection with Krishna, like he's my brother or he's my son, they don't have a connection with him. But they do. This is the nature of showing their love. They leave everything just to be with Krishna, everything for his pleasure, totally everything for his pleasure. They leave it all without a second's thought. They leave their family, their brothers, their everything. They forget it all and go to him. And this is all just set there to intensify the showing their love, and also to show that the highest love leaves everything to love Krishna. But this is so high, it's the topmost, so therefore we put it up there and we go like this. And we do our service on our level, understanding that we are very small. And as you were saying, we are very small, he is very big. This is the instruction. Yes.
Mataji, I was just wondering, maybe learning about Narada Muni so much.
Yes.
Can we consider Narada Muni as beyond a demigod?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
What
yes.
is the lifespan of Narada Muni?
Narada Muni is eternal. Narada Muni has no lifespan. Narada Muni is eternal. Nitya Siddha. And simultaneously, he appears as this sadhana example for us. But Narada Muni has no lifespan. He's called also Deva Rishi. He's the guru of all the demigods. This is, yes. Yes.
You mentioned the point that people that were at a prison when Krishna appeared, that they weren't devotees and they saw him as an ordinary person.
Yes.
But when Krishna appears in the universe in his pastimes, does he appear in his full transcendental, with his full transcendental beauty? You know, which would be really kind of mind-blowing for anybody. Does he appear like that?
Does Krishna appear in his full beauty, even though we're saying that some people can't recognize him? He does. He appears in his full beauty. But for our benefit, Srila Prabhupada would give the example. When you go to the temple in Melbourne and you stand before Radha Balava, does your heart start to palpitate? Tears flow from your eyes, the hairs on your body are standing up, and you faint? No answer. Not always. So he's also appearing there in his full beauty, but we can't see. There's a screen in the way. Kunti Devi says there's a curtain in the way. Please remove this curtain. So the beginning of that is, please help me to remember you. That's what we heard yesterday. All the sages and all the devotees, all the demigods all say, please help me to remember you. because then I can get all these things done that I want to achieve. But they still say it, because they know this. Only by remembrance of Krishna can I be happy in this world or the next world. But they're considered less intelligent because they're praying, please help me to remember you so my life will be peaceful here. So we may have a touch of that also. Please help me in my devotional service so that everything will run smoothly for me. But the higher and higher from that, we're just, please help me serve you. Then Krishna allows you to see him more. So the more you advance, the more attractive Krishna appears to you. A good analogy is, you know how children in their teenage years, they find their parents really stupid? And as they get older, they find their parents have become more intelligent? Yeah. So similarly, as we make more advancement, Krishna is more appealing to us because there's less in the way. Yes?
If the crying towards Krishna is out of our misery, we want to get out of this world, so what kind of conduct?
That's like the queen. When the king went off hunting, doing impious things will cause unhappiness. Pious things will bring happiness. This is materially speaking. So the king, the person in the body, he went off and did something impious. Therefore he got some reaction, came to him. And what happened? His intelligence just threw all the bangles and jewels away and said, I don't want to have anything to do with you anymore. I'm just going to be a renunciate. And then as soon as he assured, no, I respect you, I love you, you're my wife. We can enjoy together. I'm very sorry I didn't listen to you. I'll listen to you always from now on. What did the intelligence got up and put all the bangles on again? Everything went again. But you do it my way, okay? My way or the highway. But that's not real piety when it's coming, when one has been crushed so much. It is piety, but it's not bhakti piety. Bhakti piety would have to be reinforced by devotional activities at that time. And there's a strong purport in the Bhagavad Gita where Srila Prabhupada actually says that sometimes when you come out of distress, or you come out of wanting something from Krishna, he says sometimes it's likely that those standard of bhaktas go away. Once they've got what they wanted, they go away. So once the distress is gone, one goes away. Once one gets what one wanted, one goes away. So it's not a safe footing. One has to get into the boat and start practicing Krishna consciousness and be prepared to continue practicing Krishna consciousness and be elevated above that.
But the material miseries have been created to surrender to Krishna.
Yes, after you start to become serious devotee, then Krishna starts sending you material miseries or happiness, but particularly material miseries are favorable for neophyte devotees. Because when this is a principle, it doesn't mean that if you're looking around and think, I'm not unhappy, something's wrong, Krishna doesn't love me. But generally speaking, the miseries turn us back to Krishna. And when we're all happy and everything's going fantastic, we forget about him. And at first we don't notice how long we forget. One time when I first became a devotee, one devotee who was in charge of the temple, he told me, you should watch and see how long the gaps are. I remembered Krishna here. I'd only been a devotee for 2 weeks or something, 2 months. He said, between here and here, watch and see how long the gap is. And so I was sort of trying to figure that all out. And I could see that actually what I've noticed over the years is the gap is getting smaller. Between this time I think of Krishna and that time. I lose track, I get involved in all kinds of thoughts, and now I recognize, oh, that's not about Krishna, is it? And I try to get back. So the gap is narrowing. So the gap narrows and narrows and narrows, it becomes seamless. That's when Krishna says, come with me.
It's good to surrender to Krishna rather than to... Like, we know that the miseries have been created to surrender to Krishna. And then it's nothing wrong to surrender to Krishna. And when we are happy also, we have to surrender to Krishna. The same way.
It's good to.
Yeah, the same way. No, but because if we are taking him as a shelter.
Yes.
But it's not considered to be surrender.
Yes, it's considered to be surrender if we're taking him as a shelter. But just as you were asking, the surrender and the shelter is considered good. But it's what we do that's different than that that's being addressed. And we're looking at that and saying, that's not very good. So there's a tendency sometimes of the mind. The mind's very tricky. So what it will do is it will move over something very good and put it there and say, are you criticizing that? You say, no, I'm not criticizing that. I'm criticizing that. Are you criticizing that? No, I'm not criticizing that. I'm criticizing that. So this is the false ego. It's very elaborate, deeply rooted. That are you saying it's not good to do this? No, I'm saying that's good. Then there's something that's not good. What's not good? Every time you forget Krishna, it's not good. So then take that. And then do what is good, to take shelter of Krishna, to distribute books, to give other people Krishna, to do all those things. Have a fire to do those things. But every time you forget Krishna, that's not good. And then you've got something to work on. Oh, I've got to work on that. It may, unless you keep going. And if you keep going, you'll get a taste. And as you get a taste, the material desires will become less important. And fan that. That's what Prabhupada was saying. Fan it, that taste. Make it blazing. And then it will burn up your material desires. They won't be there anymore. So this is the process. One last one.
It's an interesting point that Narayana was making about dreams and how everything that you dream you've experienced before at some point.
Yes.
And so how should we take that information and make it useful?
Read the chapter. Read that section and then you can have questions that are based on that. It was too elaborate to take into account now. But read about that section with dreams because it's quite powerful. It gives you the insight into how Krishna can actually say, you know, you're full up, you're struggling, but you're completely failing. And Krishna can say, I want that one, I like that one. And he can do something that immediately all your karma is absolved, like that. Because Srila Prabhupada speaks about that, right? That we can just go back to Godhead in a very simple way. So read about it, it's quite interesting. And if you have any questions, maybe you can communicate them. All right. Hare Krishna. Thank you very, very much. Hare Bol.